I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Until recently, China accepted our bottles and cans, containers, milk cartons, plastic, and cereal boxes for recycling. Starting this year, it raised their contamination standards and stopped accepting some of those recyclables, which they called foreign trash. That means that the items that you think will be recycled and reused could end up in landfills, or you could be charged more money to have them recycled. Livia Albeck-Ripka has been writing about this in a series of articles in the New York Times. She's a freelance climate and environment reporter, and she joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Livia, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Let's start with China. They made this decision about a year ago, but it went into effect in January. What were they responding to in deciding not to accept of all of our recyclables?
Yeah, so last year in summer, China announced its plans to ban foreign trash from its shores. And then on January 1st of this year, that ban actually came into effect. And what it meant was that 24 different types of materials were banned from entering China. That included most post-consumer plastics, mixed paper, and some other materials as well. And for those materials that they were continuing to accept, they limited the amount of contamination to 0.5%. And there are, you know, varying opinions in the waste management community about whether that 0.5% is a realistic goal and something that can be met. And contamination could be anything from something that isn't supposed to be in the recycling bin at all to, you know, paper and plastics being mixed up in the wrong way, for example.
Well, is it because China, by accepting these materials and then finding that a certain percentage of them were, quote unquote, contaminated, that they were unable to recycle them and had to throw them into their own landfills?
Well, this is not the first time that China has actually done this. So 5 years ago, they announced the Green Fence campaign, and then this time around it was called the National Sword Policy, and it's part of a broader anti-pollution campaign where China is really trying to clean up its own country and saying to the US as well as other countries, including Australia, Germany and other parts of Europe, Canada, they're saying, look, we just don't want to be the world's garbage dump anymore, and we're not willing to accept as much trash and as much post-consumer material as we previously had been doing.
What other countries are accepting our trash?
So there were already a number of other countries who took trash and recyclables from the U.S., and it is important to make that distinction between trash and recyclables, and it's something that when you speak with people in the waste management community, they say, you know, it's really important not to think of recyclables as trash because
right.
They're not. They're post-consumer materials, and if kind of disposed of and marketed properly, this is something that's worth money and can be turned into something new. So it's important to note that firstly, and then on which other countries are accepting these materials. India, Vietnam, Indonesia, they've really been the main countries to pick up some of the slack that exists because China is not accepting as many materials. But overall, for example, you know, plastic has been hit particularly hard, the scrap post-consumer scrap plastic industry. So for scrap plastic, it's down by 90% to
wow.
China, and other countries have stepped in. But overall, it's still down by 40%.
We'll be talking more about the business of this decision or the impact on commercial recyclers. But let's talk about consumers. Where does that leave then consumers? And as you said, there's recycling and there's trash. But if China is not accepting some of this recycling, what does a consumer do?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So,
and all America is listening for your answer there.
And it's an interesting one as well. I noticed that you called people consumers, and I think that's a really interesting point to make as well. Is that, you know, And it's something I thought about during my reporting. Are we the public? Are we consumers? Are we individuals? Because I think consumers is a good word because it does indicate that we are consuming. We are buying plastic, paper, and after we've bought it, we need to think about what to do with it. So the good news is that consumers, the public, us, we can actually make a difference in all of this. We can help to lessen the amounts of contamination in our own recycling bins, in our curbside recycling. And then we can also to note that it doesn't affect everybody in the US equally. So that's another thing to point out is that, you know, the Pacific Northwest has been hit really the hardest because they were so reliant on exporting materials to China. So for those listening in New York City or Philadelphia, you know, the rules in your area may not have changed significantly since this ban came into effect at the beginning of the year. So it is important to check as to how you're being affected in your area by this ban. But having said that, there are definitely things individuals can do to make a difference.
Let me just reintroduce you. That's Olivia Albeck-Ripka, and she's been writing a series of articles in the New York Times in response to the fact that China has decided to ban a number of recyclables sent from the United States and, frankly, other countries to China to be recycled. And it's having an impact, as Olivia said, in different parts of the country. And in just about 10 minutes or so, we'll be joined by someone from Republic Services that does a lot of recycling here in the Philadelphia area. In the meantime, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. I have some very specific questions for you, Olivia, but we got an email from Anne Marie wanting to know, what did China do with the recycled materials previous to refusing them?
That is a really good question, and my reporting for the New York Times was really focused on how these policies were going to impact us here. So I'm going to say that for now, I'm doing more reporting, and I hope to be able to answer that question. But, you know, I think that the focus here is really thinking about what we can do to kind of deal with this problem here in the US and in other countries as well, rather than kind of outsourcing this problem. And waste managers are talking about this as a real wake-up call. They're saying, you know, previously we were exporting, Americans recycle around 66 million tons of material a year. A third of that was being exported, and most of that was going to China. So they're saying, this is time for people in the US and for the waste management community and recycling processes to think about how we can actually deal with this onshore, and how we can reopen domestic facilities that have the capacity to deal with these post-consumer materials, particularly paper mills, some of which had closed down when China began to accept so much material from the US and began to accept material that was far more contaminated than would have been acceptable by anyone else or anyone here.
Well, let's talk about what contamination is. And are you and others saying wash everything so there aren't crumbs or piece, you know, sticky peanut butter inside that peanut butter jar?
Yeah.
To wash your recyclables before they go into the bin? Is it that basic and that simple?
Yeah, so contamination can mean a few different things. Number one, grease. That is a common offender. So when it comes to, you know, takeout containers, wash them out, but you don't have to scrub them absolutely clean. In turn, that would waste water. When it comes to paper, if your pizza box is really greasy, or you've had a chocolate croissant and it's been in a paper bag and it's all greasy, just best to throw that away. And in some cases, you can actually compost a very greasy pizza box. But again, if there are a few crumbs in there, or if the pizza box had a liner, you can safely put that in the recycling bin, or you could tear it in half, put the good half in the recycling bin and trash the other half. And then another really big one are disposable coffee cups. So these seem like cardboard, and this is very surprising to a lot of people, is that in a disposable coffee cup, there's actually a fine film of polyethylene, and that's what makes these cups liquid-proof, of course, but it also makes them very difficult and expensive to reprocess. In some municipalities, there are facilities to cope with these cups and to separate them out and recycle them, but in many, there aren't. And in those places, the cups are really best put in the trash. So this is another really big conversation that people are starting to have. You know, how can we either change these disposable cups so that they're lined with a material that is recyclable, or that is easier to sort of separate out, or how can we just lessen our use of this? And one thing that one of the a resident in Oregon, in Eugene, Oregon, said to me when I was speaking with residents and interviewing people, she said, you know, recycling is the third R. We have to reduce and reuse first. And I think that's another really good message and a thing to think about when it comes to what we can do.
And it's the greasy, I'm just focused here on pizza boxes. It's the greasy part of the pizza box that's going to gum up the system, gum up the works?
Yeah, well, it's the fact that, so a pizza box or any other kind of cardboard is fiber. That's what it will become if it's able to be recycled and reprocessed into something new. So if your fiber is kind of, it's a porous material, if it's soaked through with oil, it's not really as marketable because you can't really separate that oil out from the paper.
You also write about yogurt cups and actually plastics that are numbered 3 through 7. These are ones that China is not going to be accepting. I don't know whether other countries will continue to do that, but yogurt cups, toss them in the trash.
Yeah, so it depends, again, where you're based. So check with your local guidelines. You know, in some places in Oregon, this has become a real problem. But 3 through 7 plastics have become less marketable since China's ban. And so a really common 3 through 7 plastic are yogurt cups. So, you know, in New York City, for example, these are definitely still recyclable. Mm-hmm. But if you're based on the West Coast, you might want to check as to whether or not these are still being considered recyclable in your area. And if not, it is best to put them straight in the trash because they are now, unfortunately, considered to be contaminants.
John has an email. Is there a viable market for use and repurposing recycled plastic grocery shopping bags? It's a single source of never-ending plastic, and that is certainly true. Some municipalities have banned plastic bags. What's the future for plastic bags, you think, Livia?
Yeah, that's another really great question. There are some states where they have a plastic bag drop-off, so you can collect your plastic bags and take them there, and then they have a special facility which deals with those plastic bags. But in other cases, if you're putting your plastic bags in with the recycling, it's likely, you know, they will just clog up the machinery, so they shouldn't be going in with the rest of the recycling. And then when it comes to bans and just reducing our use of plastic bags overall, yes, many, many countries, and particularly in the EU, are starting to look at ways of doing that or taxing those bags to limit our use of them.
And even straws now. I was in Scotland just a week or so ago, and no straws.
Yeah, I mean, we've all seen the image of the sea turtle having a straw removed from its face.
Heartbreaking.
It is so heartbreaking, and so much of our single-use plastic ends up in the ocean. You know, it's a combination of flyaway plastics that end up in rivers and then go downstream and end up in the ocean, and fishing nets as well are a huge part of the problem. scientists who study this are not sure whether it's because, you know, fishing nets are just more resilient, and so therefore we're kind of seeing more of them as whole pieces of plastic in the ocean, or because there are really so many fishing operations in the ocean. But yeah, when it comes to single-use plastics, there are a lot of places, yeah, and straws in particular, looking at how we can limit or ban the use of them entirely.
You wrote about the quote-unquote Great Pacific Garbage Patch. This was a piece just a couple of months ago in the New York Times. 87,000 tons of plastic and counting. I think when people think of a patch, they think of this giant, almost like a floating island of garbage in the Pacific. You and others have written saying that's not exactly what we're talking about, but nonetheless, we are talking about 87,000 tons of plastic. Has anyone figured out what to do about that?
Yes. So those who wrote the study are actually currently working on launching a kind of machine that effectively floats through the ocean and gathers this plastic in one area. And that just makes it more efficient for a ship to effectively go and pick up a pile of this plastic. So there were plans to launch that this summer. And it's interesting that you point out, you know, we talk about this as a patch or an island, and the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, I think, has become, in environmental reporting at least, a kind of metaphor for the problems that we have, and for our consumerism and our waste. And it is really interesting to think about how those metaphors can play a role in helping people to understand and helping us to understand kind of the impacts of consuming single-use plastics and other kind of trash and where it ultimately ends up.
It seems that this single-use plastic, if there's anything that's at least potentially on the chopping block, I don't know whether we have the technology or the know-how to figure out how to replace plastic with something else that's more biodegradable. But do you see that as kind of ground zero when it comes to recycling, Livia?
Well, that's an interesting one, because some of those single-use plastics are not, in fact, recyclable. So I guess I would see those as separate issues in a sense. You know, recycling is looking at those plastics that have a future life. So I would say single-use plastics are ground zero in terms of just limiting the amount of trash that we produce overall.
We're going to take a break in just a couple of seconds. One of the things that you wrote about that is a problem, I guess, for recyclers are bowling balls.
Yes.
People are throwing their bowling balls into their recycling bin.
Yeah, this was a big surprise to me when I was doing my reporting, and something that I had to fact check multiple times. Surprisingly enough, people are throwing away bowling balls, and not only bowling balls, but, you know, basketballs, soccer balls, that really surprising things end up in the recycling stream. Anything from Christmas lights to animal carcasses in some case. One of the waste managers I spoke to told me that he had found, you know, remnants of what he thought looked like it had come from an aquarium, perhaps a shark or something. And so the reason for this, I mean, it is so shocking and surprising, but the reason for this is what waste managers call aspirational recycling.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break, and we have another guest who will be joining us. That's Livia Albeck-Ripka. She's been writing about the environment and the climate as a freelance reporter, a number of articles appearing in the New York Times. We'll take a very short break and get back to our conversation. Stay with us. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we've been talking about the environmental and commercial impact of China saying no to some of our recyclables. They've raised their contamination standards, and that has left companies with some tough choices: charge customers more to pick up their recycling or dump those cans, bottles, cereal boxes in landfills, or maybe something else. We've been talking with Livia Albeck-Ripka, who's a freelance climate and environment reporter. And joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Frank Tamira, and he's Senior Manager for Municipal Sales for Republic Services, and that's the country's second largest recycler and second largest owner of landfills. Frank, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Lots of comments here, and I will be sure to get to them. Frank, let me just get your response to what China did, essentially banning some of their recyclables. What kind of impact on your industry?
So it's been a huge economic impact on our industry. You know, China historically was the largest consumer of the recycled materials that we were collecting and processing, baling, and then selling them off into domestic and foreign markets. So China historically consumed about 40% of the country's recyclables. And when you take that 40% out of the capacity, right, you know, the global capacity, there's not enough other processing capacity existing throughout the rest of the world to take over what's now missing.
Does that mean that we need to, as Livia was saying earlier, rethink our whole recycling process because China's essentially shut the door to so much of it?
Absolutely. I mean, currently, when you look at what these other countries are able to accept, again, there's not enough capacity. So when we are going to sell our materials, we've got to look for secondary markets, right, and the price is not as strong in secondary markets. We're looking domestic, also not as strong in the domestic market, and it's tipped the economics upside down. So we have to look for ways to, one, reduce contamination. We have to make a higher quality product when we go to sell it, because now it's a buyer's market. So those countries are looking for, even though they're not China and they're, right, not saying it has to be 0.5%, they can now look to buy the best quality material. So we all have to improve our game, and that starts at the curb. That starts with what you're putting into your recycle container when you're out in commercial establishments, because the inbound stream needs to be less contaminated, mm-hmm, in order for us to create a better product on the back end.
Are you saying that what was a money maker is now a money loser when it comes to companies like yours making money off of recyclables?
Absolutely.
So you're
losing
money.
Become a loss leader. Mm-hmm.
You know, I was thinking, I want to put this to both of you. When you think about, you know, let's use me as an example. You know, I put my stuff in my recycling bin. Then it gets what? Put on a boat to China. Then it gets processed there. Then it gets sent back to, what, let's say the United States, and gets turned into something else. Frank, is that what we're talking about? Because it seems like an extraordinarily inefficient way to deal with our recyclables.
So here's basically how the loop works. So you put your recyclables out at the curb. We come by with a truck. We collect it. That's then delivered to a recycle processing facility where we sort the material into different commodity types. We then bale those materials. So you get bales of cardboard, bales of paper, different grades of plastics and metals. We then will send them and sell them into particular markets. So that could be domestic. That could be Asian markets. So in order to get them there, you have to put them on a truck from the recycle center or put them on a rail car, get it to the port, then has to be put onto a ship, sent to that country. And there was a good relationship with China, with them being such a powerful manufacturing country, where we would send these materials over there. They would then actually recycle them, turn them back into raw material. They would use them there into their manufacturing products, and those would come back on those same ships and in those same containers back to the U.S. We would then consume them, turn them back into recycled
and
materials.
And the cycle repeats
exactly.
itself. Exactly. Is that an efficient way, Livia, of dealing with our recyclable materials?
I mean, as Frank said, you've got these ships coming over with manufactured goods in boxes that may well be made from post-consumer fiber, which came originally from the U.S., and then those boxes are arriving here, and you've got to get those ships back. And from speaking to waste managers, I understand that the cost of sent, you know, you've got these empty containers sitting here that have come over with the manufactured goods, and it's a cheaper route back than it is here. So given our current kind of consumption levels and the way that system is flowing, yes, it makes sense. But I think there are certainly some bigger questions to be asked there about that loop.
Let me read a couple of comments. We got one early on. Just got a letter from our trash hauler letting us know that recycling costs will go up significantly and immediately. It's a tough spot for us because our customers may judge us harshly if we don't recycle, and they'll complain if they are asked to absorb the increased operating costs. Frank, let me turn to you. Should people just expect to pay more for recycling? And if there isn't the market for these materials, are they ending up in landfills?
So,
or holding pen somewhere.
I would say the industry is still very long on recycling. We do see it as viable. We see it as sustainable. Historically, it has been the fastest growing segment of all waste generation. So we believe in it. The economics, though, do have to change. So historically, there is a cost to recycling that was not always visible to the consumer or to the generator, because after that whole collection process and that sorting process, all of that cost money. But the value of the material was greater than the cost. So it would offset that cost. So it was very rarely, if ever, passed on to the consumer. But we're at a point now where the value of the material is no longer great enough to cover the cost of the collection and the cost of processing. So inevitably, that cost has to be passed on to the consumer. And that's something that we are working on and helping municipalities, helping residents understand that there's always been a cost to recycling. And that cost has always been comparable to landfill. But the value of the material made that cost hidden to the consumer.
Something that Livia said earlier, I just want to run it by you, Frank, for those people that recycle here on the East Coast or in the Philadelphia area, does that get sent on ships to China or does it go somewhere else?
Currently here in Philadelphia, it's not. Historically, the majority of the recycling out of our Philadelphia Recycle Center was going to China. Mm-hmm. Currently, zero is going to China. The majority is staying domestic, and some is going international, some of those countries that Livia had mentioned. So not an outlet for us at the time.
And those plastics that are 3 through 7, if you're living here in the Philadelphia area, can you still recycle those?
You can still put them in the stream. Again, I would look to your local municipality, go to the website. If changes are going to occur within your local municipality, that's the place to get the information.
That's Chimera, and he's Senior Manager for Municipal Sales for Republic Services. Also with us is Livia Albeck Ripka, and she's a freelance reporter who's been covering the environment and climate. We're talking about the fact that China is not accepting our bottles and cans and containers, milk cartons, plastic cereal boxes for recycling. A lot of that just not going to end up in China. Let me play a clip from The Graduate. And in preparation for the show, I remembered this very important scene from The Graduate. A well-meaning guest gives Ben, who's played by Dustin Hoffman, some unsolicited advice at his graduation party.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
Exactly. How do you mean?
There's a great future in plastics. Think about it. Will you think about it?
Yes, I will.
I've said. That's a deal.
Frank, is there still a great future in plastics?
That's a great question. That's up to the plastic manufacturers to decide.
And does that all? Do they respond to consumers?
I sure hope so.
And Livia, a lot of plastic is about packaging, correct?
Yes. I mean, when it comes to consumer plastics, yes.
Let me read a bunch of emails here. One from Susan. Why don't we use glass containers for liquids as we did with milk when we were children? They were returned, cleaned, and reused. Milk, juice, sour cream, etc. Livia, is that an option for consumers?
Glass is a tricky one, and Frank, I'm sure you can speak to this as well, but it seems to have less of a market because, we can make glass out of sand, and so it's not quite as marketable as the other materials, as a post-consumer material.
You're nodding your head, Frank.
Yeah, that's true. So if you think about the materials that come into our facility that have a negative value or somebody's not willing to pay for them, right now that's about 70% of our inbound stream, and glass is one of those components and historically has been. There are some glass recyclers, but the cost to manufacture glass from recycled content versus virgin content doesn't really work out to really drive the need for recycled glass.
Again, I think that taps into this idea that we as consumers, as the public, we can reduce and reuse first. So if you have glass jars at home or glass jugs that had milk in them, you know, fill them up with water, use them for your leftovers. So kind of preventing things from going into the recycling stream in the first place is a really good way that I think individuals can do their part.
Let me pick up on something, Frank, and I'll toss it to you. This goes back to the plastics. Something like 8 billion metric tons of plastic have been created since the 1950s. Someone did a study, and they said you could cover the entire country of Argentina with all those plastics, just to give people a sense of the scope of the amount of plastics. How much of that does actually biodegrade when we're talking about plastics?
I can't really speak to the chemical structure of how those things work.
But can we assume that most of them don't, or can you answer that, Livia?
I can't answer that question specifically, but when it comes to plastics, there are some really staggering numbers that have come out through various studies. You know, a UN report, according to one UN report, less than a tenth of all plastic that's ever been made has been recycled. There are other studies that have suggested there may be more plastic than fish in the world's oceans in the future. So there are definitely some very frightening figures around plastics and around just how much we're creating and how little we are actually recycling.
Let me read. Here's an email actually from Harold. When I lived in Holland 15 years ago, there were free recycling bins in every entry at every grocery store. Beyond this, you had to pay about $7 to have a bag of trash taken away. Therefore, people in Holland don't accept the overpackaging of items. Frank, do you see that working in the United States?
It's an interesting concept. I mean, packaging is certainly drives the recycling industry. It's something that, as processors of recyclables, we are constantly chasing is the changing in packaging, the lightweighting in packaging. Certainly makes the economics of recycling more challenging as packaging changes.
Thinking about in my grocery store, there's a little box you can put your plastic bags. Do we know where that goes, Frank?
You know, it's not – plastic bags are not something that we recycle in your curbside stream, but I'm glad you brought that up because that is the number one contaminant here in the Philadelphia area in the recycle stream, whether that's the curbside stream or the commercial stream, are plastic bags. So when you see those bins at the grocery store, it's important to use those or – you know, use the first R and reduce the amount of plastic bags that you're using and use the reusable plastic bags. But it's an important distinction for those who are generating recycling to understand that putting them in plastic bags hurts the system and hurts the value of the material and increases the cost of recycling.
Do you get a lot of bowling balls?
We do get bowling balls.
You do.
We get automotive parts. We get tons of things that you'd be shocked by.
That should not be in the recycling bin, right?
Absolutely. Livia talked about aspirational recycling, and that's something we talk about a lot because people want to do the right thing and there's a push to be more sustainable, so they put materials in that they hope are recyclable.
But yeah, I think we hope as consumers that, well, somebody will figure out what to do with this down the line, somebody who isn't me. And I think that idea of aspirational recycling is a really good one to keep in mind.
Absolutely. Let me get Dave from Hatfield to join us on Radio Times. And Dave, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was basically, I do insurance inspections, and I've been inside a number of waste management facilities, and I've seen firsthand what kind of goes on when the stuff gets sorted, and we're talking about making a higher quality product that will be acceptable by other countries. I mean, we literally have people that are picking through this material to kind of separate it out. And one company I looked at, they said, well, they're going to start running it through multiple times just to make sure that the quality of the product is up to the standards that will be accepted by some of these other countries.
Right.
So my question really is what's the possibility that, you know, robotics could be introduced into this sorting process to maybe, you know, really speed it up? That's pretty much it. Thanks.
Thank you for calling into Radio Times. Frank, we're almost out of time, but I want to give you a chance to respond to Dave's question.
Sure. So there is a good bit of mechanical sorting and optical sorting, which you know, could be called robotics, that exist within the recycle process. Where the people and the hand sorting comes into play is really on the front end to try and pick out those plastic bags and those things that are obviously not recyclable to get that out of the process early. Robotics and technology and the sorting system is something that is constantly evolving, something that we are continuing to invest in to make our sorting process more efficient, because he's right. We're having to slow down the lines considerably. We're having to add more people to the lines. Sometimes we are having to run material through two times in order to get a cleaner product. And all of that is what is challenging the economics. So not only are the costs to process rising, but the value of the material on the back end is decreasing at the same time, which is what has rapidly flipped the economics of the system.
We're going to end on that note. Frank Chimera, thank you so much for coming in and joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Senior Manager for Municipal Sales for Republic Services, the country's second largest recycler, second largest owner of landfills. And Livia Albeck-Ripka, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. She's a freelance climate and environment reporter, and she had a couple of articles in the New York Times that caught our eye. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us.